in Northwest Washington.
From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Nandi Show, connecting your neighborhood with the world. Later in the broadcast, several universities in our region are building out everything from student housing and new facilities. We'll take a look at campus architecture and how new buildings fit into a university and into a neighborhood. But first, it's been 3 weeks since Virginians went to the polls, but the State Board of Elections only certified a winner in the Attorney General's race this week. Senator Mark Herring ended up ahead by just 165 votes out of more than 2 million votes cast, the closest statewide race in modern Virginia history. His challenger, Republican Senator Mark Obenshain, is asking for a recount. Joining us to talk about what happens next is Michael Pope. He's WAMU 88.5's Northern Virginia reporter and a political reporter with Connection Newspapers. Michael's also the author of Shotgun Justice, One Prosecutor's Crusade Against Crime and Corruption in Alexandria and Arlington. Michael, good to see you.
Good to see you.
Before we get to the recount, let's talk briefly about State Senator Cree Deeds, who was released from the hospital Friday. He is speaking out for the first time since that tragedy last week, in which he was seriously wounded by his son, who then committed suicide. What is Senator Deeds saying?
Well, the senator spoke to his local newspaper, a weekly newspaper called the Highland Recorder, and said, essentially, the system failed my son. It's a very tragic story. He said that the Rockbridge Community Service Board officials are responsible for what happened, and that he's going to make it his life's mission to try to reform this system, which is obviously has some serious errors.
This is a man who ran for governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia. What effect do you think his speaking out will have?
Well, it's likely to have a great effect, especially in the upcoming General Assembly session. You know, since this happened, there has been all kinds of talk about potential legislative reform. For example, lengthening the period of time you can hold someone under an emergency custody order, funding for all kinds of preventative service, psychiatric beds. And so, you know, already this very tragic and sad situation has prompted any number of potential reforms that we're likely to see as part of the upcoming General Assembly session.
Senator Deeds noting the fact that rural areas, such as where he lives in Bath County, are not well served by some of the mental health institutions in the region. So we can expect that there's likely to be movement in the General Assembly. This is truly a tragedy. Moving on to the Virginia Attorney General contest, Republican State Senator Mark Obenshain today is formally asking for a recount. How much is a recount likely to shift the outcome here?
Unknown. And the reason for that is because we're moving into totally uncharted territory here. There's never been a recount like the one that's about to happen, because the last statewide recount happened back in 2005, and the rules were totally different back then. Because that was a recount that involved, you know, back then, the way the Virginia law works is that the recount essentially took the numbers that came out of the machines on election day and compared those numbers with the numbers that were reported to the State Board of Elections. And as long as they matched, then they were checked off. So there were no ballots that were actually recounted. Interestingly enough, the Democratic candidate in that race was none other than Cree Deeds, who we were just talking about. He and his team wanted to have all of the paper ballots run through the scanner again, but the judge said, no, that's not how Virginia law works. And so there were a handful of cases, maybe four or five specific precincts, where they did run the ballots through the scanners again because of some kind of irregularity. But the, you know, that's a very small handful. For the most part, the paper ballots were not run through the machines again. So when Deeds returned to the state Senate, he introduced legislation to change how recounts work. And so this recount will be largely guided by that Deeds legislation, which says that all of these paper ballots, these are more than 700,000 paper ballots, in Virginia will be run through the scanners again. So, like I said, we're moving into totally uncharted territory here.
Questions or comments, you can call 800-433-8850. We're talking with WAMU 88.5 Northern Virginia reporter Michael Pope about the recount that is likely in the Attorney General's race in the Commonwealth of Virginia. 800-433-8850. Do you think a race with such a razor-thin margin should go to a recount? If you're a Virginia voter who didn't cast a ballot on Election Day, do you now regret not voting? Obenshain's campaign is reminding us that around the country, there have been four statewide elections since 2000 with margins under 300 votes, and three were reversed by recounts. So those seem to point to pretty good odds for Mark Obenshain in the recount process.
Well, the Obenshain campaign also pointed out that all of those examples that you just gave had a margin of victory that, a margin before the recount that was larger than our very thin, razor thin, 165 vote margin of victory in this case. So, we're talking about an election that's going to feature anywhere from 25,000 to 50,000 overvotes. And that's a lot of potential votes that have yet to be counted in this election that could totally change the margin of victory.
It looks like Mark Herring is moving forward as the declared winner and building his transition team. But Mark Obenshain has also named a transition team. I guess that's to be expected.
Well, you say to be expected, but what's to be expected? We don't really know. He does have a transition team. Considering that he may end up being the Attorney General, it's probably a smart thing for him to have a transition team.
That's what I thought. So when does this all begin? What's the process for the recount?
So the process began this morning with the Obenshain campaign sending a legal notification to the circuit court in Richmond that they wanted to seek a recount. Then the chief judge of Richmond will be the head of a three-judge panel that will be the recount court. Next week sometime, that judge will issue a preliminary order. Then the chief justice of the Supreme Court will appoint the other two judges on this three-judge panel. And then sometime in December, probably the week of December 15th, there will be a 1 or 2 day recount, followed by this three-judge panel making a final ruling. So it's likely to be a 3 day recount because some of the jurisdictions are going to have to hand count all of their paper ballots because of limitations with the machines, Charlottesville and Alexandria specifically. So in Charlottesville and Alexandria, it's likely to be a 2 day recount. Then they're going to have some contested ballots, which they will send to Richmond. The three-judge panel will probably take that third day of the recount to look at all of those contested ballots and then declare a winner.
Are there still questions about how ballots were tallied in Fairfax County? People will recall that that's where Herring took the lead after voting officials in Fairfax found that more than 3,000 votes had not been properly counted on election night. That, along with other issues.
Yeah, Fairfax County ended up extending the window of time that voters could come in and identify themselves to cast these provisional ballots. And Republicans feel like that might have been a mistake. There was a conference call this morning with the Obenshain legal team, and that question was asked. And the lawyer said it was too soon to talk about that. But I guarantee you, outside of that conference call, it was not too soon for the legal team to talk about that. I would anticipate that those provisional ballots in Fairfax County cast after the original deadline may end up being challenged.
So you're saying that by about the middle of December, we should know the results of this recount?
Yeah, mid to late. If you look at the 2005 recount, that was a one-day recount. It happened on December 20th. So we're looking at a timeline that's somewhat analogous. That was a one-day recount. This is likely to be a three-day recount in any event. Mid to late December, we probably should have a winner, but we never know what's going to come up during all of this.
But here's the kicker. This might not even be settled, even after a recount. What could happen next?
Are you talking about the special elections?
Yes.
So both of the candidates for Attorney General are sitting state senators, which means that...
No, I wasn't talking about the special election. I was talking about there's some procedure, a provision that would allow the loser after a recount to contest the result in an unusual joint session of the state's House of Delegates and Senate.
Yes, this is. There's been a lot of talk about this. It seems kind of far-fetched, I have to admit, but here's how the rules operate, apparently. If the losing candidate wants to contest the validity of the election, they can do so in the Virginia General Assembly, a very little-known process that involves a total vote of all of the members of the General Assembly. In other words, all of the senators and all of the House of Delegates essentially have one vote. You would need a majority, and Republicans have a very clear majority. So it's, you know, under that scenario, though, Kojo, the Republicans would have to be on record, you know, potentially overturning the results of an election. And do they want that on their voting record? So that is a possibility. Seems far-fetched. It would be very dramatic if it did happen.
A lot of far-fetched things become commonplace in these situations. You never know what will happen. But if we do find out about it, then we'll certainly be talking to Michael Pope. He is WAMU 88.5's Northern Virginia reporter and a political reporter with Connection Newspapers. Michael Pope is the author of the book Shotgun Justice, One Prosecutor's Crusade Against Crime and Corruption in Alexandria and Arlington. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, a look at campus architecture and how new buildings fit into a university and a neighborhood. I'm Kojo Nandi.
On the next Metro Connection, looking back, we'll revisit some of our favorite stories about our region's history, from the town that served as U.S. Capitol for a day to the African-American pilot who broke through racial barriers in the military.
The top general staff were uniform, that blacks were not good soldiers, and you couldn't be depended on.
I'm Rebecca Shear, and I hope you can join us Friday afternoon at 1 here on WAMU 88.5.
Shakespeare Theatre Company presents Man in a Case, featuring Mikhail Baryshnikov. This modern adaptation of two stories by Anton Chekhov draws upon live performance and mixed media to bring these 19th century anti-love stories to life. WAMU 88.5 is proud to be a media sponsor for Man in a Case, running December 5th through the 22nd at the Landsberg Theatre. More information is at WAMU.org under events.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from the Humane Society of the United States, dedicated to providing direct, hands-on care to tens of thousands of animals each year and preventing cruelty to millions more through advocacy campaigns. More at humanesociety.org. And from the motion picture Saving Mr. Banks, starring Emma Thompson and Tom Hanks, running in select cities December 13th and in theaters everywhere December 20th.
Drive around some of the universities in our region and you'll see bulldozers and backhoes at work, building a new law school here, another residence hall there. But before the first shovel of dirt is turned, there's often a long and laborious process to figure out what the building will look like. Some of the considerations are artistic. Are we going for a bold statement by a celebrity architect? Or do we want to preserve a uniform campus style? Other decisions, more political, of the town gown variety. How will the new structure affect the surrounding community? And how can we win over the neighbors? Indeed, keeping the various constituencies happy, from university donors and alumni to neighbors and city inspectors, is often a complex balancing act. Today, a look behind the scenes at the sometimes conflicting interests that shape university architecture. Roger Lewis joins us in studio. He is an architect and he writes the Shaping the City column in the Washington Post. Roger's professor emeritus of architecture at the University of Maryland College Park. Roger, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me again.
Also in studio with us is Thomas Heyer. He is founder and principal of Bittison Heyer, which does resource planning for universities and colleges. Tom Heyer, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You too can join this conversation. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. What's your favorite building on a college or university campus? 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Roger, let's look at a project you were involved with, the new law school at the University of Baltimore. Why did the school want, well, an eye-popping building, and Why did it decide to hold an international design competition to pick an architect?
Well, first of all, they needed a new law school just to improve the facilities, the physical facilities that they had been using. And the president of the university and the faculty also wanted to create, if you will, an iconic building that would not only serve to enhance the law school facilities, but that would contribute to the visual quality of that campus and that part of the city of Baltimore. And the competition, they felt, was the best way to attract what they felt would be the best talent. And design competitions also, if they're properly managed and properly promoted, do help fundraising, because it's a somewhat public protocol to have a design competition. That was the primary thinking at the University of Baltimore. Let's do a really great building, something that you would not ordinarily see in the city of Baltimore. In fact, it's also they went further. They pursued and I think achieved a platinum LEED rating for the building. It's a very environmentally sustainable building.
You were the professional advisor for the competition.
Yes, yes.
The University of Baltimore Law School, it sits on a prominent piece of land downtown near the train station. How does the building's apparently bold design speak to both the school and to the community at large?
Well, I should say the building, of course, doesn't look anything like any other buildings in the neighborhood or on the campus. So right away, you know, it's an exception. It's a building visually different from anything around it. It's a tall building. It rises about, I think, 150 feet. It's about 12 stories tall, taller than anything immediately in the vicinity. So it's an attention grabber. My own personal opinion is that the interior of the building, the spatial quality of the interior, is actually its greatest feature. It essentially has an atrium that sort of torsions its way up from the very ground level to the very top of the building. I think we get into this discussion of architecture and aesthetics, which being on radio is always a little bit challenging to get it across. But I think anyone who sees the building will not forget seeing the building. Whereas I think those of us who live in Washington, for example, I can drive down many, many avenues in Washington and forget every building that I've looked at. This is not a forgettable. This is a memorable piece of architecture.
One small aspect of this that caught my attention, one thinks of law school, one thinks of a building that has to hold thousands of very heavy volumes of books. That's changing.
That's changing because in the digital age, we now know that students can get to a lot of what they need not by pulling a book off a shelf, but by going via the internet to a digital library. This was a very big consideration at University of Baltimore Law School, because if you can eliminate having to store books, which are extremely heavy, necessitating structural design, structural floor load capacity that is very costly. They actually saved a few million dollars by reducing the number of books they actually store in the building.
Tom Harris, some universities, like the University of Baltimore, hold competitions to pick an architect for a bold new building. Others go straight to a celebrity architect. How does the business school at Case Western Reserve, designed by renowned architect Frank Gehry, illustrate the drawbacks of fame over function?
Well, there are many buildings that are built by well-known architects that unfortunately don't function as well as perhaps they should. I think sometimes what happens is people get starstruck. They look at big names. They also, it's very difficult, I think, to evaluate a building other than by name or fame or whatever. And so when you're a board member or the head of a university and you're looking to do something really big, you naturally go to these architects. What tends to happen is they focus on the design itself, the architecture, the exterior of the building, and a lot of the elements of the interior of the building, the things that actually make a building function and work and make it a space where people want to be, kind of get second-tier consideration. And that can have very significant implications when the building is finally up and running. If you talk to any facilities officer in a university, they tend not to say very nice things about star architects, because they have to come in behind them and make the buildings work and make the air conditioning not leak anymore and make the roofs not leak anymore, things like that.
You get a star architect, though. Can there still be some pushback against the designs, the desires of that star architect?
There can be, but it requires a very sophisticated client. The way I like to think about it is if you're a cook and you are actually know what you're doing, you can look at a recipe and you can understand what that the end product is going to be just by looking at the recipe. But if you are not a knowledgeable cook, you just wait for the finished product and then see if it tastes good. It's very similar with architecture. Most people don't know how to read plans and don't really understand relationships when they see them in two dimensions. And so you don't get to the end game. You get to the end game before you can really determine whether the building functions or not. And so most people don't feel comfortable weighing in on it, and especially when it's a star architect. It's like, you know, telling your heart surgeon, please don't take out my you know, don't fix my aorta that way. Fix it another way. You don't typically feel comfortable doing that with a star architect.
Nevertheless, and in spite of Roger Frank, Gehry designed a new building at MIT, the Stata Center for Computer Information and Intelligence Sciences. It had problems, leaks, but the people who work there like it. What's your assessment of that project?
Well, I'm delighted that you brought that up, since it's my alma mater, MIT. It's amazing. It's an amazing project, given that the client is MIT. Frank Gehry is the architect. Skanska, which is one of the biggest construction companies in the world, built it. And as I think Tom points out, you wonder why, when they were sitting in the room looking at the design, someone didn't say, wait a minute, this building is probably going to leak. They built it. There's no way to describe it for your audience other than say it's what we at the University of Maryland Architecture School sometimes call train wreck architecture. It's an extraordinary composition of form. It's a gigantic sculpture. But it was destined to have some problems keeping the weather out. On the other hand, the interior of the building, the idea, the intention of MIT was to create a building a little bit like what they tried to do at University of Baltimore Law School, which was to make an iconic structure in which the students and faculty and people from different disciplines, in the case of MIT's center, would intermix, would cross paths, would rub shoulders with each other rather than being separated. I think the Stata Center has been popular with its users because it does achieve that. It's very, there's a lot of light pouring into it in addition to water. And so, you know, they have appreciated it. It is probably a boon for some lawyers, though. The litigation is probably still going on. Yes. Tom might know the answer to that.
I don't know about that, but I know there are other buildings that Gehry has done where the roof leaks as well, so that's a common theme.
800-433-8850. We're talking about how one balances interest in university architecture and inviting your calls. How do you think, well, neighborhood concerns have affected the look of local college campuses? You can also send us a tweet at Kojo Show or email to kojo@wamu.org. Here is Jeffrey in Washington, D.C. Jeffrey, you're on the air. Go ahead. Please.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, and I wanted to thank Mr. Lewis for his insights over the years into the Washington architectural scene.
Thank you.
I just toured Dunbar High School recently, which is a LEED Platinum new school for the D.C. public schools. It's a really beautiful school, and I was interested in both of your guests' comments on the influence of sustainable design, which is commonly known as green building, on the design construction of educational buildings and how it can lead the way in saving energy and also improving the environment. Thanks.
Let's start with you, Tom Heyer.
Well, I'll let Roger comment on the specifics of the environmental stuff, but I will tell you this. I talk to a lot of students on campus, and it is their number one concern. When we ask them about what they want in buildings, it has to be sustainable. It has to be environmentally sound. One of the nicest things that students like, that you will find is perhaps amusing, there are now water fountains that have places where you can put your water bottle and fill it up because it saves on using the plastic water bottles, and they love that more than anything.
It's a generational thing.
Exactly. I mean, I think that it is absolutely coast-to-coast the phenomenon that we are now teaching architecture students to think about green building. The I don't think we have time to go into the specific tactics of what you do when you design a building to make it green. And in fact, I should mention that sometimes one of the greenest things you can do is to not demolish an old building, is to keep an existing building and modernize it so it is, in fact, usable because of all the already invested energy and money and resources. So I think today, practically every architect I know who's in practice has gotten his LEED certification or her LEED certification. I think that, Jeffrey, your comment is well taken. I think almost every building that will be built prospectively is going to be sustainable to some extent. Now, whether it gets to the platinum level or some other rating system is a matter sometimes of budget, because achieving some of the points that it takes to get the LEED ratings can sometimes cost more than doing the conventional thing. So there can be a cost to it. Those costs are coming down. I think within our lifetimes, building sustainably will not involve a premium capital investment.
Tom Heyer, you worked with Columbia University in New York on its new Manhattanville campus in West Harlem. It also includes a law school. How is the university trying to make its buildings there an integral part of the community?
Well, in Manhattanville, as our listeners probably know, the main campus at Columbia has been traditionally a closed-in campus. It was walled off. And when the university decided to expand over to Manhattanville, which is about five blocks north of the main campus, there were lots of issues with the neighborhoods about whether they, you know, even wanted Columbia there. But one of the things that was critically important to the neighbors was that the campus be porous and that it invite in the neighbors. And so Columbia committed to having absolutely no fencing around the campus. It committed to having buildings with first floor spaces that were primarily retail, wider sidewalks so that there would be, people could comfortably walk through the campus, and then a lot of services that would be kind of neighborhood serving so that people would feel comfortable being part of the campus there.
Good idea, Roger?
Yes. I think the challenge for many university campuses is this town-gown relationship. How to not just get along, but how to be an asset for the neighbors. And we here in Washington are very sensitive to this. We've got a bunch of universities embedded in or adjacent to existing neighborhoods. We can start with American University, Howard University, George Washington University, Georgetown University. They've all faced, at one time or another, or are facing now, issues of how to relate, how to in some cases expand, in some cases make changes of use, modernize existing buildings, add new buildings, how to do this in a way that is a benefit to all parties, particularly the neighbors.
Tom, you've worked with the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, which has invested heavily in the surrounding neighborhood. What is that school's approach to interacting with nearby residents?
The University of Pennsylvania made a decision a long time ago that one of the interesting things about universities, they are 100, 200-year entities. They're going to be around forever. And they can't easily pick up and move. So either when you are in a situation like West Philadelphia where it had been very crime-ridden, lots of murders, it's very difficult to recruit students when parents think their kid might not make it through the school. So the university a long time ago decided that it had to really stabilize the community. It took a number of steps. It invested eventually, I think, something like $500 million in West Philadelphia. They started charter schools. They bought up houses and resold them to faculty. They provided subsidies to faculty to be able to afford these houses. They created a business improvement district. They have a special police force. They've really done a lot to stabilize the neighborhood. But part of it is not just because of the security reasons. Part of it is part of the mission of the university to be part of the community and to let the community share in the wealth of knowledge and information that the university has. So they have education programs that they take out into the community and things like that.
We got a tweet from Andrew who says, I prefer my tuition dollars to go to my education rather than eye-popping building design. Comments, Roger?
He's not alone. I mean, I think there have been a lot of people who've questioned whether that's a good investment. And although the question is founded on the premise that good architecture necessarily costs a lot more money, which isn't always the case. It can be the case, but it isn't necessarily that creating good architecture costs any more than creating mediocre architecture. In fact, I would argue that it doesn't. I think that's one of the unfortunate biases that a lot of people do have, not including people on boards of trustees who are wondering, you know, why do we even need the new building at all? But I think that I understand that question. But the fact is, it is not necessarily that a zero-sum game where if we're spending money on a new facility or a new building, it means money has been taken away from some academic or educational mission.
In addition to which, Tom Heyer, it seems to me that when parents and students are looking at comparable institutions of higher education in terms of their academic record, one of the differences that is made in the decision that they make often has to do with the appearance of the campus itself.
That is certainly true. I think all other factors being equal, I mean, obviously, if you've got two institutions that are roughly comparable academically, when you walk onto the campus, things that students notice, they notice the buildings, they notice the green spaces, they notice how friendly people are. They notice places where students can hang out comfortably and have a good time. So I think that all of those things make a difference in the recruitment process.
We're talking about balancing interests in university architecture with Roger Lewis, architect and columnist with the Shaping the City column for the Washington Post. He's professor emeritus of architecture at the University of Maryland College Park. Thomas Heyer is a founder and principal of the firm Bidison Heyer. It does resource planning for universities and colleges. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 800-433-8850. Should new university construction, in your view, match the campus's existing architectural style, or try something new? 800-433-8850. Universities are often the largest landholders in their communities. How do local planning and zoning rules affect the way schools design for their growth, Tom?
Some schools are actually exempt from zoning regulations, depending on the nature of some state institutions. In California, for example, the universities have their own zoning. Here in Washington, D.C., and I am not by any means a zoning expert, but my understanding is that the universities abide by regular zoning laws here. A lot of our universities are in residential neighborhoods and therefore have to have special exceptions to do the kinds of things that they want. And one of the things that's interesting to me in Washington is that the process here is very adversarial. As I understand it, you are, as a university, you are, the burden of proof is sort of on you to determine that you're not having an adverse impact on the neighborhood. There are many places in the country where they actually like having their universities there and want them to do more and work together and collaboratively to do something good. Here it's a matter of saying, well, if we do this, we're not really going to have more students in the neighborhood, or we're not going to affect the neighborhood in a negative way. That, to me, seems to be a very kind of roundabout way of doing that kind
it's
of
Washington.
Thing.
It's Washington. Adversarial
of course.
Is how we roll.
Absolutely.
Roger.
Well, I can't add much to Tom. I mean, I've been involved in a couple of these adversarial proceedings with as a consultant to American University, as a matter of fact, some years back. I think the problem mostly has to do with the fact that many of the neighbors of campuses, people who live next to campuses, certainly in D.C., are worried about the impact that students might have parking their cars in their neighborhood, having parties, making noise. I think using the zoning language, I think a lot of people see universities as nuisances, as potential nuisances. It is an unfortunate perception. There has been one other thing in D.C. to mention. I certainly, in the case of George Washington University, unlike some of the others where there's a discrete campus, there's a boundary, there's a real edge, George Washington University is very much interwoven into the fabric of the city. That's a guarantee of conflict because there's actually people, private property owners who have nothing to do with the university who are mixed in with the university properties. They've tried to deal with this, but invariably there's been conflict.
Got to take a short break. When we come back, if you have calls, stay on the line. We will get to your calls. If you'd like to call, our number is 800 833-8850. Can a campus structure be a landmark both for the campus and for the community? What do you think? 800-433-8850. You can send us a tweet at Kojo Show or email to kojo@wamu.org. I'm Kojo Namdi. Coming up at 1, upgrading airport food, long security lines, and fewer onboard options mean more people eating at airports. We explore how airport eateries are rising to the challenge with celebrity chefs and healthier fare. Today at 1 on the Kojo Namdi Show on WAMU 88.5 and streaming at kojoshow.org.
When animators want to make a funny movie even funnier, they bend the rules of gravity. But they don't break them. Case in point, Toy Story.
Toys are trying to kill each other. They're like throwing each other out of windows into the jaws of dogs. I remember thinking like, wow, where there's great peril, there's great room for comedy.
Building big animated laughs today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4, you're on WAMU 88.5.
Join the Kojo Namdi Show Wednesday, December 4th at noon for a live broadcast from the Grosvenor Auditorium at National Geographic in downtown Washington. We'll talk to National Geographic explorers and Smithsonian leaders about the high-tech future of the past. This is brought to you in partnership with the Future of Information Alliance. For free ticket information, go to WAMU.org and click on events.
Rain changing to snow showers this afternoon, highs in the upper 40s, 42 degrees in northwest Washington at 1242.
Welcome back. We're talking with Thomas Heyer. He is founder and principal of Bittison Heyer. Bittison Heyer does resource planning for universities and college. We're talking about how we balance interests in university architecture with Roger Lewis. He is an architect and the Shaping the City columnist with the Washington Post. He's also professor emeritus of architecture at the University of Maryland College Park. I'd like to go directly to the phones to Elias in Alexandria, Virginia. Elias, your turn.
Hi there. I'm a huge fan of this show, and I just want to say thank you for this. This is a question more for Tom.
Okay.
I'm wondering what sort of proportion or breakdown do you see in campuses that are investing more towards the large libraries, the resource centers, the music halls, and then the residential spaces. I'm a graduate of Bard College, and we recently put up a huge Frank Gehry building, but we have a huge problem with lack of residential space for on-campus housing. Now, my question is, do you notice a trend that is, moving away from an emphasis on star architect design student spaces and more of an emphasis now on these giant buildings that, draw people from off of campus, but maybe don't necessarily help students out?
I think that the residential side is very interesting because residential architecture or residential buildings are one of the few building types on campuses that actually have a revenue stream, which means that they can be funded by something other than just gifts and state funding and things. So there's a lot of interest in privatization of housing, and there's a lot of interest in these what they call public-private partnerships to build housing. And campuses are now looking at leasing their land for 50, 75 years to private equity firms to build housing. So I think you're going to see more of a trend toward building what would be closer to market rate housing, apartment style housing or suite style housing, lots of amenities on campus. That preserves money to build other kinds of projects. And I think that most campuses that are looking at the issue of the big balancing to me is between academic buildings and support buildings. The faculty, of course, always want academic buildings, more research space, more lab space. But for competitive purposes, there is also a real interest in building more spaces that provide community for students, good student centers, more kind of social spaces where students can hang out. So they're looking at all the different options, but they're getting there in different ways now.
Indeed, Roger, in urban areas, mixed use is increasingly popular with ground floor retail and restaurants, and then upper floors with offices or apartments. How are urban universities designing their new buildings to blend into that cityscape?
Well, I think you described it very well. I mean, they are building exactly what you're talking about, more mixed-use facilities. And I think the it seems to me perfectly feasible to, on campus or next to a campus, have a building in which people are living, people are working, people are shopping. And I would, Tom, I think, would agree. I think that's the trend. I think that's where we're headed.
If you think about universities, certainly their mission is research and teaching, but really universities are all about collaboration and the exchange of ideas. And where do people exchange ideas? They exchange ideas in places where they can be together. They don't do it sitting in their private offices. Everybody I talk to, faculty, students alike, the most important spaces to them are the coffee houses, the coffee rooms in faculty office buildings, places where people can hang out. Even if they don't necessarily want to talk to each other, they want to be around each other working together. And so there's a real interest in building these community spaces, and the kind of mixed-use retail that Roger's talking about provides that sort of opportunity.
Here's Cindy in Montclair, Virginia. Cindy, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you so much. I have couple of questions. One of my children went to Wellesley College outside of Boston, and I don't know if your panelists are familiar with that. It has a science center that is a gorgeous example of taking a very old building and basically expanding the new LEED-certified science building all around the gorgeous old brick walls and patios and such. And then they also put in the Wang Center, which is an incredible student union sort of a center. It looks almost like a bird taking flight on the side of on the banks of the lake. And it has eating and activity areas and movable walls and all kinds of things that make it very flexible and open to student use. Another child is at UVA with very famous architecture, and yet here's this great big famous university, and there is no student union on the entire campus. And have people, you know, concerned about kids getting into Greek life and going off campus and drinking and all this sort of thing, and yet the university has no place that is a student center for kids and teachers to all come and congregate.
What do you say, Tom?
Well, I'm a little bit familiar with the Lang Center at Wellesley. It is a pretty impressive building. I would say that, you know, different schools have different priorities, and Wellesley is private and UVA is public, or at least quasi-public. And getting into the queue to build something like a student center can take a very long time at a public institution. I would doubt that UVA doesn't understand that there's a need for more student space, but I suspect that resources have something to do with that. On the other hand, Wellesley, being a competitive institution, is sort of in the arms race with all the other institutions of its kind. And so if others build great student centers, then they're going to probably build one as well.
I have to comment. I'm an expert on Wellesley because my wife went to Wellesley. I've spent many, 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 many hours on the campus of Wellesley, both when I was a student and a bit since then. So, Cindy, I very much appreciate what you're saying. What we need to recognize is the difference between UVA and Wellesley. Wellesley is sitting out essentially in this sort of bucolic environment, disconnected from really the urban environment of Boston, whereas University of Virginia is in Charlottesville. Charlottesville is the student union, in a way, in effect, for the University of Virginia. I think it's very important to recognize that some college campuses, we've always taught our students at Maryland that sometimes campuses are like towns in themselves. They actually operate more like a town or a city than they do an academic village. So I think every one of these places has its own unique needs. I think Wellesley College, Wellesley happens to be a college which is one of the most beautiful campuses on the planet, and I don't think there's any question that a lot of the women who go to Wellesley go there because they find that very appealing, and also the fact that it's still one of the few remaining all-women's colleges. University of Virginia is a very different animal.
If you had to compare the amount of time you spent at MIT with the amount of time you spent at Wellesley, How would that come out?
Well, I always remember going to one of my wife's reunions. I finally got to sleep in a Wellesley dormitory. I mean, that was the highlight.
We're going to have to continue this conversation off air. Here is Nancy in Bethesda, Maryland. Nancy, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I'd like to just go back to what Tom Hine was saying about Penn, University of Pennsylvania, located in West Philadelphia.
Yep.
And I think we need to look at, I recently returned to school at Penn, and at the age of 60 graduated with my social work degree there.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. And so I was embedded in the community, and that's what Penn did. And I think we need to understand that Penn shifted its development under the presidency of Judith Reardon, who is now at, and I never pronounce her last name right, but she is now at the Rockefeller Foundation. And she has written a book about how what Penn did. And a lot of Penn's changes was in response to the way the African-American community had been replaced by some of the buildings. And there was a sincere reflection and consideration. And when the university offered staff and faculty subsidies to buy housing, so it was not just upper crust faculty, or, I mean, you know, highly educated faculty. It was, mm-hmm. you know, it was people across the spectrum who work at Penn, and Penn is the largest private employer in Philadelphia. And it was also, they've also done a lot to stabilize the area so that people, African-American families who have lived there for generations, can stay there. It's a huge philosophy, and I don't want it to be looked at as just something to cater to students, but it's really taking to heart.
I think you underscore the very point that Tom was trying to make
in
the beginning.
Absolutely, and Penn is perhaps, in my view, one of the best institutions in terms of working with the community. They have a real commitment to the community itself. Judith Reardon, when Judith Reardon was there, I was working with her on some of these issues, and I know that she was very committed to the idea of righting some of the wrongs that had happened in West Philadelphia over the years. And they subsidize affordable housing, and they do all sorts of things. It's really, to me, one of the great models of university-city collaboration.
Indeed, we got an email from Mike who says, universities are trying to live down past real estate development atrocities. Many urban campuses, GWU in D.C., NYU in New York City, have gutted their neighborhoods in the pursuit of Mayman. So the new emphasis on sustainability is a sort of greenwashing. Roger, the biggest town-gown friction seems to involve residents' complaints about the behavior of students either living in or passing through their neighborhoods. Neighbors want student housing as deep inside the campus as possible, but universities seem to prefer to have an academic core and put dorms around the edges of campus. How is that tension being addressed in this region?
Well, gingerly, it's being addressed. I mean, I think that points out what is an inherent conflict. I mean, there is a logic to designing a campus, making campus plan in which the housing is not at the center, is peripheral, is next to other housing. I think that what was talked about earlier mentioned by Tom, I think the kind of housing that's built actually is consequential. If you when I went to MIT, we lived in dormitories. You were in a single or a double. They were guaranteed to make noise. I mean, it was just it was not conducive to living in a more civilized manner that I think, for example, suite occupancy or apartment style living accomplishes. I was just involved recently in a new dormitory that was built at Gallaudet, and there was great concern, obviously in this case, for hearing impaired students, but they also can make noise. I mean, they're not any quiet.
Oh, I lived in a house with hearing impaired students.
And there was a great deal of attention paid. It goes back to what Tom said earlier, to the communal space. You know, to making spaces where the students weren't tempted to go off and make noise somewhere else, party somewhere else. I mean, I think design can contribute to resolving this issue of juxtaposing housing in which students live with housing occupied by community citizens.
Tom, neighborhoods would really like universities, I guess, to house more students on campus, but mm-hmm. students want to be, especially after freshman year, closer to neighborhoods.
I always say, you know, universities are great places to have if you just could get rid of those pesky students. I mean, that's sort of the that's sort of the view, I think, of some of the neighbors. The truth is there's a developmental progression of students. First-year students absolutely should be on campus, and they should be in traditional residence halls. When you get to be a sophomore, they're looking more for suite-style housing, and if you provide that on campus, that's terrific because you want to build a sense of community on campus. I mean, one of the things that my clients tell me is if you only have first and second year students on campus, you lose the sense of tradition. People, older students pass traditions to younger students. So I think there are some real good reasons to have more students on campus. Having said that, some students, by the time they get to be juniors or seniors, they really do want to kind of have that rite of passage, move into the community, live on their own. But I think the biggest issue, in my view, is alcohol, because what students leave campus because they can't drink on campus. And the fact that our drinking age is 21 instead of 18 or 22 means that you've got this sort of in-between thing going on campus. Some students can drink, others can't. The ones who can't pre-drink, and then they go off campus already drunk from four or five drinks, and then they create problems. So I think every institution that I know of is working very hard to manage this problem, but it's a very difficult problem to solve under our current laws.
We're almost out of time, but I wanted David in Washington to have his 30 seconds. David, that's about all you have. Go ahead, please.
Okay, well, I'll be very brief. First, I want to say that I'm a former university chancellor, and I also headed parts of school design for 20 years, and I've worked with Frank Gehry and quite a number of other architects. I want to underscore and endorse the comment about good design and money. Good design is about talent, not money. Now, having said that, I would also say that there's a real obligation here on the part of the nonprofit community for design, because the...
You got 10 seconds.
Okay, the profit-making community is responsible to the bottom line.
And I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Tom Heyer is founder and principal of Bittison Heyer, which does resource planning for universities and college. Tom, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Roger Lewis is an architect and the Shaping the City columnist for the Washington Post. He's professor emeritus of architecture at the University of Maryland College Park. Roger, thank you.
And thank you.
Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up tomorrow on the Kojo Nandi Show, Take the A-Train. Duke Ellington was born in D.C. and made his name in Harlem. He went on to compose standards jazz musicians live by. A new biography explores the private man behind the music legend. The Kojo Nandi Show, noon till 2 tomorrow on WAMU 88.5 and streaming at kojoshow.org.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from Zuckerman Spader, a national litigation boutique representing law firms and lawyers across the country in legal malpractice suits, ethics investigations, and business counseling. When the lawyer you choose matters most.